And now, the man who brought down Nixon, Mike Cannon.
Welcome back to the second hour of this week's Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. Coming up next, an LGBT news magazine I bring you each and every week about this time. That'll be followed by a Women's E! News, Corporate Watchdog Radio, some Eco News, including Ask Mr. Green, to name a few. You're listening to the show because you don't like the regurgitating news sanitized by corporate handlers you get on corporate media. It is our goal and pleasure to bring you these alternative voices corporate America does not bring you. Thanks for listening.
You're just in time. Enjoy the show.
This play is the story of two different female-to-male transgender individuals and the gender therapist who sort of connects their lives even though she doesn't know it.
It's a coming-of-age story. It's written in the voice of a 15-year-old girl. She lives on the Jersey Shore, and her cousin, her 14-year-old sort of pre-gay flaming queen cousin, comes to live with them, and he gets connected to everybody's life in the community and upsets her, and then he disappears.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. India's coming out party pushes sex law reform, genderqueer theater examines standards of care, and an Oscar-winning youth advocate's absolute brightness. All that and a lot more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Steve Levin.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 5th, 2008. Hundreds of LGBT people and their supporters took to the streets of Calcutta, Bangalore, and New Delhi on June 29th in the largest displays of pride ever held in India. Some marchers in each of the three cities wore rainbow-colored masks to hide their identities. But one participant, openly gay lawyer Alok Gupta, told the Associated Press that this is a national coming-out party. He called the overriding demand of the marchers a simple thing. We are seeking the right to love. Activists have mounted a protracted legal challenge to Section 377 of India's Penal Code, which criminalizes consensual adult same-gender sex as carnal intercourse against the order of nature, punishable by up to 10 years in prison. While it's a rarely enforced remnant of British colonial rule, India's conservative government believes it's representing predominant social attitudes by defending the retention of the law. Opponents charge that it implicitly supports discrimination and is used to bully and extort LGBT people. The country's high court on July 4th agreed with the NAS Foundation, the non-governmental LGBT and HIV/AIDS advocacy group that's challenging Section 377, to fast-track the case and scheduled a full hearing for July 21st.
LGBT people and their allies also marched with pride in two European cities this week. In the German capital, the parade started for the first time in what was formerly East Berlin, winding its way to the Victory Column in the west of the city. Tens of thousands refused to let occasional showers rain on their parade, and a rose was placed at the recently dedicated monument to LGBT victims of the Nazi regime.
In Paris, popular openly gay mayor Bertrand Delanoy was among a half million people celebrating LGBT pride under a river of rainbow flags. He's been mentioned as a possible Socialist Party candidate for president in 2012 and has stated publicly that he thinks France is ready for an openly gay head of state.
At the annual Pride March in New York City, home of the 1969 Stonewall Riots, which Pride events around the world now commemorate, crowds cheered Governor David Paterson a month after he directed state agencies to provide marriage benefits to same-gender couples who've been legally wed elsewhere. He was the first New York governor to participate in that city's Pride parade.
Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick was also warmly received at the annual Pride parade in Boston in mid-June, where he marched with his youngest daughter, Catherine, who'd come out as lesbian a few weeks earlier. Tens of thousands also celebrated Pride in mid-June in Indianapolis, Indiana.
The traditional Dykes on Bikes led off the 38th annual Pride Parade in San Francisco on June 29th, but this year, many of them wore bridal veils, wedding gowns, and tossed bouquets in celebration of the recent California Supreme Court marriage equality ruling, which took effect on June 16th. Thousands of same-gender couples have already married in the state, despite a looming November ballot initiative that would overturn the high court ruling and constitutionally ban them. Arizona's legislature voted this week to put a similar proposal on their state ballot. Voters will also decide on a constitutional same-gender marriage ban this November in Florida.
Members of the Canadian Armed Forces, marching in uniform for the first time, were among about 5,000 participants at Toronto's LGBT Pride Parade on June 29th, before an estimated 1 million spectators. Military personnel also staffed a recruitment booth at the parade's starting point. Canada lifted its ban on military service by open gays and lesbians in 1992.
But LGBT people and their supporters had a difficult time celebrating Pride in three Eastern European cities this week. The Associated Press reported that dozens of protesters attacked the July 5th march in Budapest, pelting participants with eggs, bottles, and rocks, and throwing bricks and Molotov cocktails at police officers who were guarding them. At least 45 protesters were arrested, and two officers were hurt in the melees. Two gay businesses in the Hungarian capital were firebombed earlier in the week in advance of the Pride March. No one was hurt by a gasoline bomb that exploded in the basement of Action, a gay bar, but fumes from the subsequent multiple firebombing of Magnum, a gay sauna, injured at least one. Phone calls to the venues right before each bombing warned people to evacuate, but LGBT activists called them terrorist attacks. Pride parades had been held for several years in Budapest without incident until last year, when ultra-nationalists and skinheads attacked some of the marchers with bottles, smoke bombs, and Molotov cocktails. While police officials had expressed concerns about violence at this year's Pride March, city officials nevertheless issued a permit to a right-wing group to hold a counter-demonstration along the same route. A message on the group's website said, "We will not tolerate foreign perverts of whatever color forcing their alien and sick world onto Hungary."
About 20 people were hurt as a mob of 150 nationalist extremists launched a tear gas attack on the first ever Pride parade in the Czech Republic on June 28th. Two Pride marchers and one police officer in the country's second-largest city of Brno required emergency medical treatment. Various reports said that from 3 to 7 anti-queer protesters were arrested. The attack ended the planned two-hour parade after about 20 minutes. The route had already been shortened after protesters threw eggs and fireworks into a crowd of about 500 participants who'd gathered at the starting point of the march. Czech-born lesbian tennis legend Martina Navratilova and the country's human rights minister, Zamila Stelikova, reportedly attended, but were not injured.
Riot police arrested about 60 far-right demonstrators who were protesting Bulgaria's first-ever Pride March in the capital city of Sofia on the same day. One man threw a gasoline bomb near the marchers, numbering about 150 people, while others hurled eggs, rocks, and bottles at them, but no serious injuries were reported. Religious leaders and right-wing groups had demanded that the march be banned. Even socialist Prime Minister Sergei Stanishev said he was uncomfortable with what he called the manifestation and demonstration of such orientations. The far-right Bulgarian National Union had called for open resistance to the march with a week-long campaign featuring posters that read, "Be intolerant, be normal." The group's leader was among those arrested.
In other news, what some critics are calling a church within a church was created at the conclusion this week of the Global Anglican Future Conference, a gathering in Jerusalem of hundreds of bishops, clergy, and laypeople, mostly from the church's African, Latin American, and Asian regions, who oppose LGBT supportive actions taken by the North American branches of the Worldwide Christian Consortium. The new body, called the Fellowship of Confessing Anglicans, will have its own bishops, clergy, theological colleges, and will embrace disaffected Canadian Anglican and U.S. Episcopal congregations who also oppose the queer-inclusive paths their branches have taken, including the consecration in 2003 of openly gay New Hampshire Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson. While the fellowship, composed of some 300 of Anglicanism's 800 bishops, insists that it wants to remain part of the 80 million member communion, formation of the new group represents a direct challenge to the authority of the church's titular leader, Archbishop of Canterbury Rowan Williams. A statement issued by the breakaway bishops said that, "We do not accept that Anglican identity is determined necessarily through recognition by the Archbishop of Canterbury. Williams, who's unsuccessfully tried to walk a theological tightrope and hold the communion together, criticized the new group, saying that to improvise solutions that may seem to be effective for some in the short term will continue to create more problems than they solve. The impact of the split will likely be evident at the Lambeth Conference, a once-a-decade Anglican policymaking gathering scheduled for later this month in London. Several prominent conservative bishops are boycotting the meeting.
Retired Republican U.S. Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina, who many believe to have been the most homophobic politician in modern American history, died at the age of 86 this week. He infamously charged that the New York Times and Washington Post are both infested with homosexuals themselves. Just about every person down there is a homosexual or lesbian. Commenting about gays and AIDS, he said that it's their deliberate, disgusting, revolting conduct that is responsible for the disease. Few in the LGBT communities will mourn him, and fewer still will miss him.
The so-called Marriage Protection Amendment, another attempt to define matrimony as exclusively heterosexual in the U.S. Constitution, is being introduced in Congress, a predictable Republican tactic during an election year. Two defenders of heterosexual marriage are among its co-sponsors, U.S. Senators David Vitter of Louisiana, identified last year as a client of a major Washington, D.C. prostitution ring, and Larry Craig of Idaho, who still maintains his heterosexuality after infamously being busted last year for soliciting an undercover policeman in a Minneapolis airport restroom.
And finally, the rabidly homophobic American Family Association distributed a very queer Associated Press story about U.S. Olympic sprinter Tyson Gay on its online One News Now network this week. While the AFA is not identified anywhere on the site as its registered owner, the group always changes the word gay in the so-called news stories it posts to homosexual. Although the Associated Press was credited as the source, the AFA rewrite, which has since been taken down, was headlined, "Homosexual eases into 100 final at Olympic events," and included such gems as Tyson Homosexual was a blur in blue with red and white diagonal stripes across the front, along with matching shoes, all in a tribute to 1936 Olympic star Jesse Owens. And Homosexual qualified for his first Summer Games team and served notice that he's certainly someone to watch in Beijing.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 5th, 2008, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Steve Levin.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
His unusual gay teen character may have disappeared at the Jersey Shore, but our reporter finds the author on the other coast later in the program. Gender issues are getting more and more exposure in the popular media, but that has not necessarily translated into more space for trans people speaking for themselves. Enter the award-winning playwright Tobias K. Davis. Davis is a trans man whose latest work, Standards of Care, found a world premiere home with the 20% Theater Company in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He and artistic director Claire Avitable spent some time with This Way Out correspondent Dixie Treichel.
Tobias, tell us about how you began the process of creating this play and what the main idea of it is.
There were a few different people that I knew in my life who were struggling with different issues that I found inspiring. This play is the story of two different female-to-male transgender individuals and the gender therapist who sort of connects their lives, even though she doesn't know it. There is David, who is an older F2M. He's in his 30s and further along in his transition, and he is back in therapy because he is pursuing bottom surgery, and he needs a letter from a therapist in order to achieve that. And so he's seeing this therapist named Nancy. And meanwhile, Nancy has a daughter, Jessica, who is starting to explore her own identity and realizing more and more that she is also female to male and becoming this new character, Jason. Nancy is having a lot of trouble with that, even though she deals with trans people in her professional capacity. And she's also struggling because there is some romantic chemistry happening between her and David. And so this triangle sort of comes out of that dynamic when Jason goes to the local queer youth center and finds a mentor in David. So everybody knows everybody, but nobody knows that everybody knows everyone else. It's sort of a standard love triangle.
Female to male transgender characters, why are those in the play?
I'm trans myself, and it's very important to me as an artist and as a trans person to create opportunities for trans people to be seen and to have their stories told. There's definitely an educational component to my work, but I also think that it's important to have plays that trans people can go to and say, yes, these are my stories.
The name of the play is Standards of Care. Tell us where that comes from.
There is a document which therapists in the United States are strongly encouraged to follow when treating transgender patients, which is called the Harry Benjamin Standards of Care. The real title's a little bit longer. It's basically a guidebook for, you know, how they're supposed to diagnose whether somebody is really, in fact, transgender, whatever that means, what sort of steps people need to follow in order to transition. And a lot of people in the trans community feel that it's kind of a very rigid document that doesn't allow for a lot of flexibility of identity and that requires some unrealistic things of trans people. For example, you know, that they try to live as the opposite sex without any hormones, without any surgery. And for some people, you know, the way they are physically, that's just not safe or reasonable. Mm-hmm. So part of what I wanted to do with the play is look at that process and critique that a little bit.
Is that process changing?
Definitely. There are a lot of people out there, trans people and mental health providers, who are working to change that. There are different guidelines popping up which are saying, you know, that trans people really are healthy and sane individuals who are capable of making informed decisions about what they want to do with their lives and their bodies without having to go through all these hoops. And I think that that's a really positive thing.
Tell us how you came to the conclusion that you were a trans person.
I was a first year in college, and I, at that point, was identifying as a lesbian because I had realized that I was attracted to women. It was this little epiphany where I was talking to a friend. I said something funny, and she thought that was funny and went to write it down and asked me what my name was, which was very feminine. And she said, oh, I just never associate that name with you. And I had this moment of, you know, me neither. She was like, it's much too girly. And I was like, yeah, not only am I not girly, I'm not a girl. I'm not a woman. That's not something that I identify with. And it's like, uh-oh, what does that mean? So, but I was very, very fortunate in my experiences at Smith that there was a supportive trans community and ally community there. I struggled with some depression around that, too, because you feel like the whole world's got this gender thing figured out, and what's wrong with me that I don't? Gender is a social construct, and no one really fits into these sort of rigid gender roles that have been established, that there really is a lot more diversity to the gender experience.
The writing and producing of a play like yours concerning transgender issues, it gets this information out in a very creative way. They're not crazy, and they're not killing somebody, and, you know, is that some of your concerns while you're writing?
Definitely. I always set out to try to write plays where someone who knows nothing about the trans community and has never heard of anything transgender can come and sit down and watch the play and understand it and feel connected to these people because of the sort of basic human experiences that they're having, but also where someone who is trans can come in and say, yes, that's me, I relate to that, and see sort of an interesting story about somebody who's like them.
Claire, how did you get involved with this?
Toby and I went to Smith College together. It's a women's college in Western Massachusetts. He wrote a play with a lot of monologues that also dealt with the transgender community, and we co-directed it. It was a wonderful experience, and I really fell in love with his writing and with his stories and what he was trying to do.
Tell us about 20% Theater.
Our mission is to produce new and progressive work by female, transgender, and genderqueer theater artists, primarily plays written within the past 10 years or so. We focus on not necessarily having just women or trans people on stage, but making sure that they are employed behind the scenes as well. The name 20% Theater originally came from a study that the New York Council on the Arts did in 2002, which the results basically said that roughly only 20% of professionals in theater were women. We are always accepting script submissions and proposals to direct plays or be part of plays or design productions, create new works, etc. And all of this information can be found on our website, which is www.tc20%.org.
Tobias, tell us about your book.
I'm working on a novel for young adults right now that's about an FDM in a boarding school in high school. I really like teenage characters. There are two teenage characters in Standards of Care. very fortunate to be friends with Ellen Whitlinger, who's a young adult novelist, and she's been helping me with the editing process. She just actually released a book called Parrotfish, which is a YA novel about a trans character. It's kind of the first F to M character in a young adult novel. I collaborated with her on that book. I was sort of her trans expert.
Is there a distinction between transgender and transsexual?
Language is sort of very fluid and always changing, so people have very personal connections to different definitions. The general use is that transgender is an umbrella term for anyone who transgresses traditional gender roles and identities. Transsexuals are generally folks who desire to live as the opposite sex they were assigned at birth. I like the term trans man when I'm describing myself. I'm a trans man because I think that I do identify as a man, but I have a trans history.
Are you finding that more is opening up for FTMs?
I think there are.
I think they're still pretty hidden.
It's not really a huge cohesive movement at this point, although there are a lot of people working really hard to increase awareness about FTM issues. I think one of the important things that the trans movement is doing is fighting for the rights of people to determine their own pronouns and have that be respected, and to determine their own names and have that be respected. I think that's really important. You know, and I think it really is a matter of respect. It's not about, is somebody convincing me enough that they are a man or a woman or whatever? It's about common courtesy and saying, oh, what would you like me to call you? And then respecting that.
That was trans man playwright and budding young adult novelist Tobias K. Davis. Dixie Trichel spoke with him and the 20% Theater Company's Claire Avitable in Minneapolis.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
This Way Out's roving reporter Steve Pride was at Book Expo America in Los Angeles a few weeks ago, where he found a relatively quiet corner to chat with author, actor, activist James Lacine. The man behind the Academy Award-winning film Trevor and the hotline of the same name was there to promote his first novel, Absolute Brightness, The Mystery of Leonard Pelkey.
And what's it about?
It's a coming-of-age story. It's written in the voice of a 15-year-old girl. She lives on the Jersey Shore in Neptune, New Jersey, and it's one summer when her cousin, her 14-year-old sort of pre-gay flaming queen cousin, comes to live with them, and he gets connected to everybody's life in the community and upsets her, and then he disappears. And the book is really about her trying to figure out what happened to him and where he went.
This is your first book. Why did you suddenly decide to become an author?
I actually started as an actor and a writer, and I would travel around the country doing these monologues, playing these different characters, and I just thought maybe I could write a really long monologue and not have to actually show up every night to do it. And also, I felt that there was something that I wanted to say about the nature of good and evil. I actually didn't write this book as a young adult novel. I started to write it actually as a kind of, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird or Member of the Wedding kind of book, and something that dealt with some social issues, because I was sort of fascinated by this whole thing that's happening in the world where people are either evildoers or they're good people, you know, that there's a way in which everything's getting divided up into either you're good or you're evil. And I felt that a novel was the right way to be able to deal with the complexities of character and bring out the fact that each of us has within us the capacity for evil and each of us has the capacity for goodness.
How did you feel about that when you thought you wrote one particular genre and then you said, oh, look, a young adult novel?
Well, I don't think anybody actually starts out writing for young adults, you know, really. I think what you do is you write a book and then you find that people can sell it in a particular way. And that's great, because to be perfectly honest, I've ended up in this world of young adults. And as you probably know, I wrote a film called Trevor, and I founded the Trevor Project, which is the only 24-hour suicide prevention helpline for gay and lesbian teenagers nationwide. And so I have like some kind of connection to young adults, and especially, I think, to gay teens. But I wanted to write something that would include more than just gay teens, that would actually include kids who are dealing with issues of that they know gay teens or that maybe they're related to a gay teen. So I created this character.
What inspired this particular story?
I think it's very hard to figure out where any story comes from, except that there are some parallels in our own life. And I come from New Jersey, so it seemed like a logical setting to set it in New Jersey. And I've had amazing times on the Jersey Shore, so I suppose it comes from it in that sense. But other than that, it came from my imagination.
What do you want readers to take away from the book?
I would just hope that they would be able to have a conversation and a dialogue about the complexity of good and evil, and also the complexity of assigning labels on people, especially in the young adult world, like labels about sexuality, and you know, before young people are able to actually figure out what and who they are.
Now, you mentioned the Trevor Project. Tell us a little bit about how that all began.
I wrote a film in 1994. It was called Trevor, and it's about a 13-year-old boy who, through a series of diary entries, he discovers that he's gay, and he tries to commit suicide. And it's very funny, and it's also very touching and heartbreaking, but he lives. And when we sold the film to HBO to put on TV, they suggested that we might want to find something like a 800 number that a kid could call if they saw the film out in the Midwest somewhere and they related to Trevor. And when we investigated, we found that there was no suicide prevention helpline specifically for gay and lesbian teenagers, which meant, you know, we went away and created it. And that was 10 years ago. You know, it's been an amazing experience because of the people who've been involved, and we have a big fundraiser in L.A. and in New York every year, and we get about 1,500 calls a month. Lately, our volume has been going up. I think the statistics are pretty alarming, which is that gay teens are 3 to 4 times more likely to commit suicide than their heterosexual peers. It's just the lack of support, especially in the Midwest and in the South, continues to be really alarming, where these kids don't have any options. So sometimes Trevor is the only way that they have to connect to anybody, to a friendly ear. And, you know, we don't really actually do anything except listen to kids and try to offer them the realization that they should wait, you know, that not to make a permanent solution to a temporary problem, is what we say.
Well, now you're out and about meeting teens, promoting your book. What kind of response have you had from teenagers to Absolute Brightness?
It's been good. You know, I think one of the things that kids are very keen, you know, they're very smart, especially reading teens, and they're not easily fooled. They're very attuned to, like, truth-telling. So one of the things that they like about the book is that not everything is sewed up so neatly, that there's some ambiguity to the characters, and there is what I think is, you know, complexity, which they like. They don't like labels to be put on people and, you know, decide who's good and who's evil, that there's some questions involved.
What do you enjoy most? What do you see yourself doing more of?
I think all of the things that I do have to do with telling the story, whether it's the Trevor Project, whether it's, you know, allowing teens to actually tell their story to people, or me telling my stories, or, you know, being an actor telling other people's stories, or being a screenwriter and, you know, making a story. It's really about story, and it's about the power of story in all of our lives, and it's the thing that we can kind of gather around to find meaning. And I just don't understand what I would do with my life if I didn't have the outlet to be able to actually tell stories or to listen to them. I think it's how we come together as a people.
From Book Expo America, we've been talking to James Lacine, author of Absolute Brightness and founder of the Trevor Project. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
You can find the Trevor Project online at www.thetrevorproject.org. The U.S. helpline number is 1-800, the number 4, the letter U, T-R-E-V-O-R. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Christopher Gall, Steve Levin, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Dixie Trichel, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. To receive weekly email alerts describing the content of each This Way Out, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening on KDUR Durango, Colorado, 3BBB Ballarat, Victoria, WVEW Brattleboro, Vermont, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Y'all stay tuned.
This is 93.3 WMRB Wausau. Free people, free radio.
Women's E-News, weekly summary of news about women, women's issues, and from women's perspectives. From the weekly Cheers and Jeers column of July 12, 2008. I'm Sandy Billings. Leading with good news, cheers for winners of the Gruber Women's Rights Prize. Three prominent women's rights activists will share the $500,000 Gruber Women's Rights Prize from the Peter and Patricia Gruber Foundation. Yanar Mohammed, co-founder of the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq, has opened shelters and safe houses for women threatened by domestic abuse and so-called honor killings from their families. She is also publisher of Al Mosawat, the only Iraqi print publication that calls for full equality for women. Sapana Prada Mala, a lawyer and president of the Forum for Women, Law, and Development, fights for legal reforms to protect women's reproductive rights in Nepal. Mala helped initiate legislation to criminalize rape in the country. Nader Shalab Kevorkian, a Palestinian feminist scholar, therapist, and activist, has worked to end violence against Palestinian women, especially honor killings. She has trained female activists in the West Bank and Gaza, where she also established a hotline for reporting abuse. More news to cheer this week. The governing body of the Anglican Church in Britain approved the consecration of women as bishops on July 7th. The decision was not billed as final. Church legislation to implement the change is to be debated next year, and the Church of England officials say a female bishop will most likely not be consecrated before the year 2014. India's lesbian and gay rights movement had its first large public parade display May 29th in New Delhi, Kolkata, and Bangalore. Indian activists are fighting to reform a 19th century law that bans homosexuality. New York Governor David A. Patterson said he will sign into law a change in the state's domestic violence law that will permit everyone in dating relationships, including same-sex couples, to seek civil protection orders from abuse in family courts. Currently, the state's domestic violence law allows protective orders only from spouses and former spouses, blood relatives, or the other parent of an abused person's child. Henry Morgenthaler, a leading abortion rights activist, received the Order of Canada for his contributions to the country. Morgenthaler, now aged 85, opened Canada's first abortion clinic in 1969. And now for the bad news of the week. Jeers for lack of leadership on women's issues from the G8. Women's issues failed to climb to the top of the agenda of the Group of Eight Global Summit this week. The group is composed of the eight wealthiest nations. The G8 met in Japan to address the world food crisis, but the status of women was not a focus, despite an acknowledged inability to meet the United Nations Millennium Development Goals to improve women's health and reduce poverty before the 2015 target date. The New York-based international women's rights organization MADRE called on world leaders to recognize gender discrimination as a threat to global food security. The organization noted women are the majority of the world's farmers, growing and processing 80% of all food, but are often denied the right to own land and are excluded from government programs. More news to jeer this week. Domestic workers in Saudi Arabia are subject to serious human rights abuses. They experience months or years of unpaid wages, forced imprisonment, physical and sexual abuse, and lashings for false charges of theft, adultery, or witchcraft. This, according to a report from the Human Rights Watch. Saudi households employ approximately 1.5 million domestic workers, mainly from Indonesia, Sri Lanka, the Philippines, and Nepal. The report is based on 142 interviews with domestic workers, senior government officials, and labor recruiters in Saudi Arabia. In Cambodia, Mu Songcha, a woman running as an opposition candidate for parliament, said she was assaulted by an army general on June 30th, and she accused the government of violating fair campaign rules by allowing the military to support government candidates and interfere in campaign activities. An activist group also said a local official attempted to run over Musosho with his motorcycle, then repeated his threats over Radio Free Asia. Jenny Williams and Magodongo Malangu of the human rights activist group Women and Men of Zimbabwe Arise were arrested in the capital Harare and have been in jail since May 28th. They were charged with disturbing the peace and publishing statements prejudicial to the state. In a political crackdown stemming from President Robert Mugabe's disputed victory in the June 27th election, about 900 camps set up by his party are detaining women and girls and keeping them as sex slaves. Presidential candidate John McCain misrepresented his position on equal pay on the campaign trail, according to Americans United for Change. The advocacy group said McCain told an audience at a Hudson, Wisconsin town hall meeting that he was, quote, committed to making sure that there's equal pay for equal work, unquote. But the group points out that the senator from Arizona publicly criticized the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act and was absent from Congress when the bill came up for a vote. U.S. women earn 77 cents for each dollar a man earns. Golf for Women magazine will cease publication in August since it is struggling to attract advertising. The magazine has a circulation of 600,000 and was purchased by Condé Nast in 2001. The conglomerate has also shuttered Sports Illustrated for Women and Women's Sports and Fitness magazines. In memoriam, on July 9th, family and friends held a service in Lawrence, Kansas for 25-year-old Jana McKay. McKay was a second-year law student and a women's rights activist and was known for her support of sexual assault survivors. She was also involved with the National Organization for Women and lobbied for a pro-choice political action committee in Kansas. Her ex-boyfriend, Adolfo Garcia Nunez, was arrested on July 4th in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and charged with her homicide, but died in his jail cell from an apparent suicide. These news briefs were compiled by Besa Lucci. Rita Henley Jensen is the editor-in-chief. This production of Women's E-News is brought to you by VP Foundation and Yen Radio. Background music is by Joan Hickey. This column and more news about women can be found at the Women's E-News website, www.womensenews.org. For Yin Radio, I'm Sandy Billings.
You are listening to a radio. Because of the time it takes for radio to travel to Earth from distant sources, radio astronomers are able to see the universe as it appeared more than 10 billion years ago. The artificial radio broadcast you are listening to now portrays the universe as it was just 1 second ago. Stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
This is the weekly viewpoint from Corporate Watchdog Radio, a commentary from experts in corporate sustainability. This week we hear about how one company, Timberland, is using new online social networking tools to promote sustainability. Here's company spokeswoman Robin Giampa.
Earlier this summer, we at Timberland launched a new campaign linking our sustainability work with everyday people concerned about the environment through new media websites such as YouTube and Facebook. This Earthkeepers campaign inspires individuals to take actions, both large and small, to shrink their individual environmental footprints. The networking power of the web connects this community around the world, turning all of these individual actions into a global movement that can make a real difference in helping solve the climate crisis. Our goal is to gather 1 million consumers who share Timberland's passion for protecting the environment. We're offering a $5,000 prize to the Earthkeeper who makes a great video about lightening their environmental load, posting the video on the Earthkeeper page on YouTube and promoting it on the changeagents.com site, a social networking site linking change agents with backers. Change agents like Elizabeth Redmond, who invented a device that can turn human movement into energy. The Earthkeepers campaign is helping to seed a growing trend using social networking sites to connect companies like Timberland with consumers around improving our sustainability as individuals and companies. The key question is, how do we make these connections effective? With the advent of Web 2.0, it's becoming much easier to communicate environmental, economic, and social issues to lots of different people. Other companies are pushing this trend too. Patagonia's Footprint Chronicles website tells the whole story of their supply chain, good and bad, and invites consumer feedback and ideas on how to improve things. That's just one example. For years, Timberland's been passionate about the connection between commerce and social justice. But in the past, we were only able to share our sustainability initiatives with a narrow group of other companies and sustainability experts. Web 2.0 makes it possible for Timberland to connect with consumers more directly. We go where the consumers are. Social networking sites like Facebook, video sharing sites like YouTube, blogs, and more. Timberland just launched a dedicated page on justmeans.com, a social responsibility networking site. This web platform allows us to update the public on a regular basis on what we're doing to improve our sustainability. We follow our quarterly updates with a conference call for the public to weigh in with their feedback. Giving people the chance to engage with us directly is a novel move in corporate sustainability, and we're excited about its prospects. We at Timberland are passionate about sustainability. It's not an option for us. It's encoded in our DNA. We look forward to working together with you and other companies using online social networking to make the world a better place for all. For the Corporate Watchdog Radio Viewpoint, I'm Robin Jampa for Timberland.
And you can find links to Timberland's Earthkeepers website and their page on justmeans.com at our website, cwr.org.
Workers' Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham. AFL-CIO President John Sweeney says the new Union Veterans Council will give a voice to veterans who want real change, both in veterans' issues and on the economy.
With the formation of the AFL-CIO Union Veterans Council, veterans will be front and center in the effort to put our country back on track.
Jim Wasser is a veteran and IBEW member featured in a new AFL-CIO political TV ad campaign.
I'm worried about four more years of continuation of a bad economy. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing. I want people to know about McCain's agenda and to call on all vets and working people to let McCain know that his agenda is wrong on pocketbook issues.
Wasser says McCain has repeatedly voted against expanding veterans' benefits.
Veterans need to know how McCain has voted in the years he's been in public office. He's voted against veterans' health care. He's voted against an increase in a minimum wage. And he continues to promote bad trade deals to send our good jobs overseas.
The Union Veterans Council will be reaching out to union voters and to veterans with the message that while McCain's military service is respected, his votes as a senator have been against the interests of both veterans and workers. Some workers at Chrysler's Toledo North Assembly Plant say it's a living hell there because Chrysler and the UAW are not stopping repeated sexual harassment of workers. The Detroit Free Press reports that a federal judge and investigators have affirmed allegations from some workers that company and UAW officials turned a blind eye to the harassment and have failed to protect workers. The paper says neither Chrysler nor the UAW responded when asked for comment. 9 federal lawsuits have been filed against Chrysler for alleged sexual harassment at that plant, and there have been 45 civil rights complaints about it in the past 18 months. Walmart is opposing former Arkansas police officer Jimmy Singleton's efforts to win permanent disability workers' comp payments after he was beaten and shot on duty. Ken Harper is Singleton's attorney.
I think it's an awful case for them to try to get involved in. Here we have an officer who's just doing his duty. He's beaten, shot, and left for dead on the side of the road. And the treatment that Officer Singleton has received from the Arkansas Workers' Compensation Commission, I don't think has been a whole lot better than the treatment he got that night.
The Restaurant Opportunities Center recently won a $3.9 million judgment for 250 restaurant workers against the Fireman Hospitality Group in New York City. Sekou Sibi is co-director of the Restaurant Opportunities Center. He says the restaurants were violating tip and wage laws.
Stolen tips, wages not paid properly, minimum wage violation, and the sexual harassment cases. And we felt like this is something that was big and needed to be fixed.
You can get WIN Labor News delivered straight to your cell phone. Just call 425-527-7001. That's 425-527-7001. Workers' Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Hey there, sexy. Have you come to play? That's right, big boy. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
It's summer berry season. Who doesn't love summer berry time? I think berries are one of nature's greatest gifts. Of course, in a few weeks, I'll be telling you it's tomatoes, but for the time being, it's berries. Sweet red and black raspberries, tart red currants, and soon, fat, juicy blackberries. Berries have the briefest of shelf lives and are incredibly fragile. They also turn moldy in half a heartbeat. It's for this reason berries should be purchased as soon as they are harvested and eaten as soon as they are purchased. Fortunately, there are numerous farmers markets and pick-your-own places in the Central Ohio area. A great resource, by the way, is the website pickyourown.org, which lists not only pick-your-own farms by county, but also provides great recipes for preserving, as well as a seasonal fruit and vegetable calendar, so you can plan your menus before heading to the markets. I think the best way to enjoy summer berries, aside from eating them out of hand, preferably while picking, is to give them just a brief rinse and place them in a bowl and sprinkle over just the tiniest bit of sugar. Even half a teaspoon will do. Give them a stir. Within a few minutes, the berries will have released their juices. The simple preparation is good on its own, over plain or vanilla yogurt, on ice cream, pound cake with cookies and smoothies. Well, I could go on and on, but you get the point. If you don't like seeds, you can make a very tasty berry sauce. Some fancy restaurants might call this a coulis, by placing the berries in a saucepan, sprinkling them with sugar, and giving them a nice crush. Heat over medium heat for just a few minutes, and when they are very juicy, strain them through a fine mesh strainer. At this point, you can use the juice as it is, or make it into a syrup by placing the juice back into a saucepan and adding more sugar. Half as much sugar as juice is a good place to start here. Bring the juice to a boil and boil gently with a watchful eye for about 5 minutes. This syrup can be used in any of the previously mentioned ways or used to flavor ice cream or to make spritzers or cocktails. From RestaurantWidow.com, I'm Lisa the Waitress, and you've been listening to In Season with Lisa on WCRS, LPFM 102.1 and 98.3, Columbus Community Radio.
It's time to ask Mr. Green from the Sierra Club. Trisha in Cincinnati wonders, how can I persuade the company I work for, a nationwide restaurant chain, to adopt a recycling program?
Well, Tricia, try to start a pilot program in your workplace that other outlets can emulate. The first step is to find out what the recycling programs are that are offered by the city's commercial haulers and what types of waste they take. Then ask if they pick up recycling for free or at a discounted rate. Next, try to identify an environmentalist in management and explain how recycling can save money and help reduce global warming. And it's good PR to boot. For more ideas, go to earth911.org and click on Business Resources or contact the Green Chamber of Commerce. If your recycling venture succeeds, you can move on to promoting energy conservation with efficient lighting, water heating, and insulation. Then you can kick back and listen to your supervisors gloat about how they're saving money and the environment.
Ask Mr. Green and learn a lot more online at sierraclubradio.org.
To paraphrase Mark Twain, we really have only two things to worry about. Either we have oil or we don't. If we have oil, there's nothing to worry about. If we don't, there's still only two things to worry about. Either we can react fast enough or we can't. If we can, there's nothing to worry about. If we can't, we don't eat. Both Michael Pollan and Richard Heinberg have commented on the dependence of industrial agriculture on oil. Pollan is the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, which deals with food, and Heinberg is author of Power Down, which looks at oil. Both are well known in their respective fields. The following is a discussion of agriculture's dependency on oil. It was compiled from interviews with the two authors conducted by Bruce Wirth and Tom Allen in the spring of 2006. Michael Pollan.
Right after World War II, and you can date this to some precision, to 1947, which is the day when all the munitions plants were converted to making fertilizer, we began eating from a fossil fuel food chain. And our food chain now doesn't just trace back to that farm field in Iowa. It goes all the way back to the Persian Gulf, where that oil and natural gas are coming from.
Richard Heinberg.
We've really boxed ourselves in the corner in this country as far as oil is concerned. At this point, I think, in the lower 48 U.S., pretty close to 90% of the oil originally in place that ever will be extractable has already been extracted. The 1930 discovery of new oil in the U.S. peaked, and then extraction peaked in the 1970s. We've created an urban infrastructure, interurban transportation systems, agricultural system, all completely dependent on oil at every stage.
Michael Pollan.
Arguably, the most important invention of the last century was figuring out a way to take nitrogen from the air and turn it into fertilizer. Ammonium nitrate. It was done first, actually, to create the explosives for wartime. It was done by a man named Fritz Haber, a German chemist, who figured out the trick. And it takes copious amounts of fossil fuel to do it, a great amount of heat and pressure provided by electricity, and natural gas is the feedstock, or you can use oil. So a plant that can use that intense fertilizer the way corn can does very well in a cheap fuel economy. And corn is really the SUV of plants. I mean, it really can suck it up.
Richard Heinberg.
We're in a difficult situation in this country. Farmers could not grow their crops if they did not have chemical pesticides, fertilizers, herbicides, if they didn't have fossil fuel farm machinery and the ability to transport their crop in large quantities, long distances.
Michael Pollan.
Every bushel of corn takes about a third of a gallon of fossil fuel. And to grow a steer takes a barrel of oil to get your steaks. Most of us don't realize that our energy problem is very closely tied to our food problem, because a fifth, 20% of the fossil fuel we burn goes to feeding ourselves, to fertilizing the plants, processing the food, turning that corn into high fructose corn syrup and a million other things, and then driving it around the country.
Tom Allen.
That's really, to me, the most ominous of all of the problems is those associated with agriculture.
Michael Pollan.
They're all connected. To give you a comparison, we think it's about cars, you know, but that's 18% of our fossil fuel is personal transportation. 20% is food.
Bruce Wirth.
How do Americans begin to recognize the impact of their diet on the planet, decide they're going to change their diet if they're sheltered from that information?
Michael Pollan.
Well, I think the first step is knowledge. I mean, we're eating in ignorance, basically, and we need to eat in full knowledge of what's involved. It's something that everybody knew 100 years ago. There would have been no job for me 100 years ago. The idea that you need a journalist to tell you where your food comes from, and that is all lost, willfully. The industry does not want us to dwell on this. So I think the first step is making the food chain more transparent.
Bruce Wirth.
What are some ways that you can get more connected with your food and, let's say, make a difference on that?
Well, get out of the supermarket. The farmer's market is one of the ways, because unless we support the small farmers near our cities and communities, sprawl will just take over. And once that land goes to houses, it's never going to go back to farmland.
Tom Allen.
This is such an important issue. Why do you think it hasn't gotten more media coverage and more attention in Congress?
Richard Heinberg.
Well, this is a story that requires that we take a long-term overview, and it requires some education. Not too many news outlets are willing to undertake the process of educating their readers or viewers to that extent. Then, for politicians, there's really no upside to this story. You can point out a problem in the world and then point out some bad actor and say that you're going to fix the problem, you have a solution. Every politician likes to do that. But if there's a problem for which there is no easy, immediate solution, whose solution will actually require some very difficult behavioral changes that nobody really wants to undertake unless they absolutely have to, that's a message no politician wants to be associated with.
Michael Pollan.
The great thing about food, as compared to so many of these other really difficult issues we faced, having to do with energy and our relationship to the earth, there's a lot we can do when it comes to food. We're not powerless by any means.
Richard Heinberg.
All of these things can be solved. We can reform our agricultural system, and ultimately we're going to have to.
There's still only two things to worry about. Either we can react fast enough, or we can't. Richard Heinberg.
The question is, will we do it in a proactive way, in a systematic way, or will we simply wait until all hell breaks loose?
For KBCS, this is Tom Allen.
Explore the many decades of popular music Thursday nights on Round Trip with Neil at the Wheel. Two solid commercial-free hours of rock, blues, jazz, folk, and everything in between. That's Round Trip with Neil at the Wheel, Thursdays from 7 to 9 p.m., only on 93.3 WNRV LP Wausau.
Kokoschka, it just happened again.
Sad, so sad.
They struck the museum like a hurricane.
Sad, so sad.
All of our culture.
white shirt, it's dead and it's gone.
Sad, so sad.
From Babylon, baby, back to Babylon.
Sad, so sad. There's stuff you find along the way and stuff you leave behind. And it all ends up with stuff that you can buy on eBay.
This week.
Sad, so sad.
I got $25 for a Persian vase.
Sad, so sad.
Hold the critique, I think I'll go large.
Sad, so sad. That stuff inside your houses and that stuff behind your eyes. Well, it all ends up as stuff that you can buy. Tower out of wrappers and cans. Sad, so sad.
Now he's speaking a language that we all understand.
Sad, so sad.
Tongue-tied and starry-eyed.
Sad, so sad.
It's the ancient history of old-school times.
Sad, so sad. There's stuff dressed up as truth and then there's stuff dressed up as lies.
Doing. shooting of 23-year-old Carlo Giuliani in the riotous streets of Genoa has sent shockwaves around the world.
Could you cross that forevermore?
Don't ask me what these do when there is so much to do. Don't ask me where I'm going, 'cause I'm just following you.
Your community radio station, 93.3 WNRB-LP Wausau, offers a variety of Hmong language programming throughout the week. Daily Hmong language programming can be heard each and every day from 7 to 8 a.m. and again from 6 to 7 p.m. Also check out additional Hmong language programming featuring Carl's World from 11 to 1 p.m. Monday through Fridays, right here on your Free People, Free Radio community radio station, 93.3 WNRB-LP Wausau.